This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, everything you need to know about an enormous riverfront development that is proposed for Charlotte and coming up for a vote at City Council. But first, on this Election Day, what? It's Election Day? Who knew? We turn for a moment to Michael Dickerson to check in on voting. Michael, of course, is Director of Elections for the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. You must be as busy as a one-arm paper hanger this morning. Michael, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It has been such a contentious year on the campaign trail and even in the courtroom regarding election laws. So are you glad that it's Election Day?
Yes, I think we're ready to put it behind us. get this going and get it done with. You're exactly right. And I think a lot of the people are, too.
So the polls opened, what, this morning at 6:30? Is that correct?
6:30. Closed tonight at 7:30. If you're in line at 7:30, you get to vote. If you're in line at 7:30, get into the line at 7:31, they're going to turn you away. So,
that's a long time. It's 13 hours of voting today. How have things gone so far this morning?
So far, so good. You've got your standard issues that we have, getting into the precincts and making certain that everybody's up and running. But so far, so good. We're kind of pleased with it. This is our sixth election in the past since September of 2015, so we're getting pretty good at it.
Statewide, 45% of registered voters actually voted before today, either through early voting or absentee voting. So what were the numbers in Mecklenburg County?
I think we're going to be close to 304,000 that have already voted early, which puts you at probably a 45% number of the 9,000 registered voters that we have here now. So that's a great number, and considering you're expecting maybe anywhere from a 65% to 67% turnout, that only leaves about 160,000, 170,000, 180,000 people to show up today.
So I'm sure it will depend on the precinct, but on average, what do you think wait times will be today to vote, and when would be the best time to go vote if you haven't got a lot of time?
That's the key. If you've got the best time to vote, it's probably going to be a mid-morning time right now, where folks have already gotten to work and have stopped by before work. Usually it's that early morning rush hour crowd that will vote. And it's also that after work rush hour crowd that will vote. Okay. So anytime in between there, you might be able to get in there and get out.
You and I talked last week with others about some of the suspicions about this election and about the accusations that it might be rigged. And we talked about how you really can't rig it and how these machines, these voting machines, never touch the internet. But there are people who say they're going to be wearing red if they're going to vote for Donald Trump, or white if they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, so that they stick out and will be easily spotted by poll watchers. Have you seen any poll watchers today?
No, we've had the credentialed poll observers that show up in precincts, but they've already been notified by to our office by the two local party committees, the Dems and the Republicans, they're in there. I haven't heard of any details of anybody outside the 50-foot marker trying to intimidate or harass. So that's kind of what we expect. We didn't really see anything in the 17 days of early voting either.
And that is the rule. If you're going out to keep an eye on things, you can't cross the 50-foot mark, and you can't stand and loiter in the voting room. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you really can't watch somebody vote, and you can't stand near the table where they're giving out their name and address information, because that's an invasion of privacy.
You're exactly right.
Okay. So what's this day going to be like for you as the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections director?
Well, we're looking at, again, handling all the little things that will come up with an election day. And hopefully having everybody closed down and not have any lines at 7:30, we can post an early 7:30 results with the absentee by mail and the early voting. We'll post about 304,000 votes right off the top, and then we'll be sitting here in our office waiting for the precinct to actually close down and drive their stuff in here.
Is the Grady Cole Center still Election Central?
No. They haven't used that for the past few years. Nobody went to it anymore. Okay. Since it's all on the internet and everybody can, you know, go to a tavern and watch it, or you know, have a party at the headquarters, they seem to just do that. So that's fine with us. But we're hoping that our larger precincts, I've got some precincts up in North County that have probably already voted 70-80% of what we expect them to turn out.
So when do you think you might be able to report out a definitive statement about who won which race?
Well, of course, we let the numbers do the talking, and the statewide races, obviously, it'll matter as to how all 100 counties report in. But you would hope by, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock, we're going to have most of our results up and posted for everybody to take a look at.
So is it just a matter of you taking the raw data from the voting machines, precinct by precinct, and then feeding it into a master computer that spits out the tabulation? Is that what happens, essentially?
That's literally what happens. But remember, in my county, they don't email it to me, they don't put it over the phone line, they literally drive it down here. So they have to close their machines, and then they literally have to, one of the judges has to get in the car and drive it down to our office.
Wow.
And from our office, we verify the numbers and closed everything, plug it into the system, and that's it.
And to be clear, it's tamper-proof on the way down?
Well, yes, I would say so, because they've not only that, they also mail me a result list in the mail.
So which would come in days from now, but nonetheless, you're going to get a tabulation that should agree with what the machine the copy has when you get it. Okay, Michael, thank you very much. Michael Dickerson, Director of Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. If you haven't voted, go vote. Now's a good time, he says. And they'll be open until 7:30. If you're in line by 7:30, you get to vote. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mike.
By the way, you can listen tonight for in-depth coverage of election results right here on WFAE. WFAE and NPR reporters and political analysts helping you follow the returns from around the country. And we're having one of those parties that Michael mentioned a minute ago from the Free Range Brewing Company on North Davidson Street, beginning at 7 o'clock. Well, one of the biggest planned developments in Charlotte history may be coming to the banks of the Catawba River, 1,300 acres on which they plan to build thousands of homes and apartments and millions of square feet of office space, shops, restaurants, hotels, parks, and green space with access to the waterfront. This Ballantyne on the Catawba is called the River District and will take decades to build out. There will need to be more roads, water and sewer lines, more schools, to name just a few of the infrastructure needs. That's all in the future. But this mini-city comes to Charlotte City Council for a zoning vote on November 21st. So we've invited several people to join us and to explore this new opportunity to push west. And we begin with Eli Portillo, who has covered this extensively in the Charlotte Observer. Eli, welcome back. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
This project was unveiled, I think, in March by Crescent Communities and Lincoln Harris. Place this on the map. Where exactly will it be?
So if you're familiar with where Charlotte Douglas International Airport is, it'll be west and slightly south of that, and basically between the airport and the river, or between 485 and the river, if that's an easier reference for you there.
And what's there now? Is it just wilderness, or do people actually live there?
There are people who live there. It's mostly undeveloped land. A lot of the land, about, I believe, 900 acres, is owned by Crescent Communities, which started life as a spinoff of Duke Power. Mm-hmm. And this land was, you know, used for timber, but mostly kept undeveloped.
So can you get there from here, or do roads have to be constructed?
Well, you can get there, but you'll definitely need a lot more roads in order to develop this intensely. I've driven out there, and it's very strange in some ways, because you get down West Boulevard, and then you can turn onto some side roads there, and very quickly you don't feel as though you're in Mecklenburg County anymore. You get past the airport, and the planes don't even fly over there because of the north-south orientation of the runway, and you feel in a very throwback rural world.
Kind of like the Whitewater Center area. But that was going to be my next question. Noise from the airport. And you're saying there's no noise from the airport, really? Because we've heard West Side residents complain about the airport noise. None?
Well, I've been out there, and there's a little noise, especially if you're on the eastern side of the site close to the airport, but not really nearly as much as you would expect because the runways are north-south for takeoffs and most landings, and planes just don't fly over a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles west of the airport. They can't turn that sharply.
One of your key jobs at the Charlotte Observer is to cover development and developers and what's going on with that and growth in the city, et cetera. How has this land remained untouched for so long?
Well, there's a lot of factors there. I think access with roads that you mentioned is one factor. Another factor is the sewers, and gravity is a big factor there, and we can talk a little more about that. But the land slopes, and it's kind of a little more rugged than a lot of other parts of the county, and you would need to build pumping stations. So it's much more expensive to run sewer lines out there than some places that have developed more rapidly. And also, I think a lot of it has to do with, again, the land being owned by Crescent, as we talked about, which was a land management company that wanted to keep it as a timberland for a long time and didn't feel pressure to develop it.
So what's changed?
Well, I think we've talked about this a few times before, but Charlotte is growing very rapidly. I wrote a story a few weeks ago about the demographics of this city, and we are somewhere around number 9, depending on how you cut the numbers, in terms of fastest growing cities in the U.S. And we've got about 109 new residents a day from 2010 to 2015. That includes births, but a lot of that is people moving to the area. So there's a market, and there's land that's owned by a developer, most of it, and it's time to develop it, they believe.
Only longtime Charlotte natives will remember that the Park Road Shopping Center used to be a farm. South Park, I believe, also used to be a farm, and that's its development is relatively recent. And even more recent is Ballantyne, which there was nothing there in 1985. Nothing.
Not even then in 1995.
Exactly. So put this project in comparison to South Park and Ballantyne and what has happened there in the last 40 years.
Well, I moved here in 2009, and I was really surprised to discover how recent and how young Ballantyne was.
Yeah.
I went back and looked actually at some of the Charlotte Observer articles about when it was first announced, and they had the same tone that we use now of, wow, this is all farmland, and they're actually going to build stuff here. In scale, Ballantyne is probably a decent starting point to think of. Ballantyne right now has about 4 million square feet of office space in Ballantyne Corporate Park, and the River District is seeking permission to build up to 8 million square feet plus residences.
But in terms of land size, I've called this a massive project, and I guess it's because it entails so many different pieces, from apartments to homes to businesses, etc. But when you look at it on a map that I looked at yesterday, it doesn't look that much bigger than the airport. And that doesn't seem massive to me. It just seems airporty, if that makes any sense. Is this massive? Is it bigger in land mass than Ballantyne?
Not in total acreage, but in terms of the amount of stuff that would be built there, offices, shops, retail, houses, apartments, it would be comparable, if not bigger, in some parts, like more office, for example. In terms of land mass, Ballantyne is bigger. But this would be more intensively developed and more dense.
Eli Portillo is an economic development reporter with the Charlotte Observer, who is on the politics beat today, but only for this hour. He's talking about economic development. When we come back, we'll meet some other folks, and somebody intimately involved in this project, in fact, to talk more about the River District. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI-PBS Charlotte's Carolina Impact, featuring tips on how to get a better night's sleep and learn the causes of insomnia. And Water Buffalo are offering local foodies a taste of Italy tonight at 8 on PBS Charlotte. And Bojangles, featuring the two-piece dinner combo with leg and thigh, made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit fixin', and a drink. Bojangles, serving the Carolinas since 1977. Tonight on WFAE, you can listen for in-depth coverage of the election. WFAE and NPR reporters, along with political analysts, will help you follow the key national, state, and local returns. Coverage begins at 7. You can listen right here or on WFAE.org. And you can join us tonight at 7 for an Elections Night Results Watch Party at Free Range Brewing on North Davidson Street. You can listen and watch coverage from WFAE, NPR, and PBS. Info at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, we've had more access to information during this election than ever before. But the news landscape has been littered with misinformation. How fake stories have shaped the presidential race.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the River District, which is going to be a piece of land that will be highly developed if all this goes through between the airport and the Catawba River. We'll talk more about that as we go through the hour. Eli Portillo is here from the Charlotte Observer. He's the economic development reporter there, or one of them. And let's meet a couple of the other people involved with this project, and one, in fact, who is intimately familiar with Charlotte's growth and what needs to be considered as that growth continues. First, we're joined by Brian Leary, president of commercial and mixed-use development at Crescent Communities, one of the developers behind the proposed River District. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning.
And Mary Newsom is here. She's associate director for urban and regional affairs at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, and she's been watching this since her newspaper days at the Observer. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I was going to ask you, Brian, who found this land, but Eli pointed out a second ago that it's been in under the control of Crescent Development for a long time, which was an arm of Duke Energy, and they run the chain. They run the water chain along the Catawba River. So when you're talking about developing it now, and you've kept it in your back pocket for a long time, and there are people who live there, is it a matter of buying them out and starting all over and moving them out? How are you doing this?
No, in fact, it's actually working with them. We've had a number of meetings with folks that already live in what might be called the River District. We sold land years ago on Lake Wylie, and they live there now. We had a public hearing and meeting a few months ago. We had over 200 people, most of them kind of live in the area. So to your point, it is a big area, and folks do live out there right now. And many of the folks who live out there right now are so glad finally some services might be coming, some increased infrastructure, grocery stores, some things like that.
So you announced this idea, I think, in March. That's when it came to light. How long have you been working on it?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, our first meeting with the city was well before March. It was actually in 2014, and this is something we've had in our land management group. So we've been managing the land and raising timber and foresting that and doing best management practices there and cleaning it out. And to your question earlier to Eli is I think the stars are starting to align. The airport is a much more efficient, less noisy place than it might have been 40 years ago. Airplane technology is improved. The runways are mostly north and south. This is on the other side of the airport. Most of the other submarkets in Charlotte are now in many ways not affordable. Mm-hmm. Try buying an apartment in South End or Uptown or South Park. And so we thought it was time to put this into production, land that we've been farming really with timber. And we started a process with the city in a real public-private partnership. We knew we had one idea. Let's go ahead and turn it into a walkable mixed-use environment. And many times people want to use the Ballantyne reference, which I think is a fine one, maybe just from a size and a quality standpoint. And by the way, Ballantyne's not done yet developing either.
Right.
So it still has a ways to go. So if you want to compare what the River District is proposing to be 30-plus years from now to what Ballantyne is today, it's a little bit of apples and oranges. If it's apples to apples, it's maybe two different types of apples. So we started the conversation. Well, let's create a place out here, a new collection of villages. And you said it's a piece of land. It might be more of a collection of land that we have owned for a long time that Lincoln Harris is working with the owners to rezone, to create a series of villages and walkable mixed-use centers.
It's going to be the first area, I think, of any massive – of any size, of any consequence on the water. I suppose you can refer to Lake Norman and Lake Wylie, but this seems different to me somehow. Is it?
Well, I'd say it's different because it will not be a waterfront development because the areas that we have that actually still touch the water, a lot of the land we sold to people who live on the water today, and we're not talking about rezoning that or doing any development there. The areas that we do have been identified for public space, parks. So we won't have – it won't be like even Rock Hills development on the river. It will be more of a public connection to the river, ideally through the woods, kayak landings, things like that. There'll be no marina. There'll be no kind of waterfront bars.
Why not?
Well, you know
– that seems to be attractive.
Well, I think we might have enough of that at Lake Norman and some other places. We thought that this land was, at least to us, is pretty special. And so the first lines we drew out there when we were drawing the master plan were the streams. And then the next line we drew were the watersheds. And the next line we drew were the steep slopes. And the next line we drew were the trees that had been there for a long time. And so we really believe that most of America and a good deal of Charlotte is craving a reconnection to nature with all the amenities of the city.
I guess the challenge here is it's rural. It's undeveloped at the moment. It's kind of wilderness except for pockets of people and their homes. And the challenge, I would imagine, is to keep it seemingly that way. And yet you're going to add 4,000 apartments and single-family homes and 500,000 square feet of shops and restaurants and retail and 8 million square feet of office space. How?
Over almost 1,500 acres. That's the thing. If anyone who's really interested in this, go drive out there and realize kind of how vast the area is. A couple of things. I think the key is grouping these uses together. We've seen through the last 50 years that when you spread everything out and you separate uses, you then make it more expensive and difficult to connect those uses. So for years, we had zoning that made shops be a distance from residential homes, a distance from where we work. And so then we had to drive everywhere because we couldn't afford or we didn't think far enough ahead to put transit in. So now by clustering this development into villages and town centers, we'll be able to preserve over 40% of all the land that's out there will be preserved and won't be developed at all.
It doesn't seem, Mary, to be a lot of – I haven't heard any – a lot of opposition to this. And it sounds like they're taking a lot of different pieces of the puzzle into consideration in some sort of a responsible manner. What's your take?
I went to the public hearing and there was – you're right. There was a lot of sort of – this is a great – idea. This is a great project. Some of the most cautionary notes came from city council themselves, talking about 120,000 motor vehicle trips per day. If you calculate out the number of houses, you know, and kind of scratching their heads, how in the world do we manage all of this? There wasn't a lot of talk about schools because city council doesn't pay for schools. There wasn't a lot of talk about parks. The developers are saying they'll set land aside and let the county buy land for parks or buy land for schools. But there was a guy from the Sierra Club, I happened to be sitting next to him, who made a very strong statement saying, wait a minute, what the heck are you doing? This is a huge development. Have you planned for transit? Well, no, because there's no money for transit. The other thing that I've heard rumblings, but I didn't hear anybody really talking about it publicly, was public access to the waterfront. You mentioned Rock Hill. There's a great trail in Riverwalk, 4 miles. You can walk right along the Catawba River. It's fabulous. It's been jammed every time I've been there. I don't think anything like that is planned here. Maybe Brian can give more information about that. It looked like you couldn't run it all the way down the riverfront because the property just doesn't work that way. But I think there might be more opportunities for more of that, if possible.
Well, I heard you say that there are pockets of opportunities along the river because some people have homes along the river. You're not taking those away from them. That's private property.
Right. No, Mary, we would absolutely love to have what Rock Hill has. The challenge a little bit is the land that we have control over or own is much less. And where you would do a river walk, there's a palisade and some bluffs that would kind of be an issue. But no, I think one of the things we've committed from day one is that those areas of the waterfront will be public. They will not be private. They will not be won't be someone's backyard. And so we think that's really important because think about the city limits of Charlotte doesn't have any place where it touches the river as far as I know.
Eli, you and I have talked about this many times when we talked about development and the reasons for these 10,000, 20,000 apartment units that have gone up around town, particularly in the Uptown, South End, Elizabeth, et cetera area, is that millennials want to live there. They don't particularly want to own. They watch what happened during the housing crisis. They want to be mobile. They want to move to the next hip area. And that makes sense because that's – and they want to live in an urban environment. This will not necessarily be an urban environment. Does it make sense to build 4,000 apartments?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at an urban environment. This won't be, for example, another Uptown or another NoDa, but this will be something different than a subdivision with three houses per acre, five houses per acre. So this will have some of those mixes of uses that we've talked about as being attractive to people in the M-word millennial demographic. And as the token millennial here, I can attest that if you put a brewery out there, you'll probably solve all those issues. But I think that this will have some of those things that really attract people who want to live in a denser environment, like shops, restaurants, retail, and offices that you can walk or bike to. So I know from talking to Brian that that's one of their aims.
So I have this big number, this 4,000 units, housing units, apartments and single family. How are you dividing them up? How many apartments versus homes? And well, what kinds of homes? How big?
I'm glad you asked that because you said a second ago 4,000 apartments. And right. We're not proposing 4,000 apartments. Right. Most of the housing out there will be probably single family homes. But our goal on day one, unlike maybe some other master plan developments in the past, is that it's actually mixed income so that a millennial getting their first job or a boomer retiring and everyone in between or folks maybe working at the airport, not necessarily flying the plane but maybe even loading baggage, could find a home there. And so we have a commitment to affordable housing day one.
Am I hearing affordable housing?
Absolutely you are. And the other thing too, as you mentioned about millennials, who's out at the Whitewater Center right now?
Millennials.
Mm-hmm. And it's many ways the millennials are flooding into South End. Why? Because you've got that vibrancy and a mix of uses. You have access to jobs. And so we think that those same millennials who are also heading out to the parks and the Whitewater Center want to be connected to nature.
So in terms of price point,
sure.
from apartments to single-family homes, what are we talking about? What do you envision?
Every price point. We really do. I mean, I know
million-dollar homes? Half-million-dollar homes?
Well, we can't underwrite a million-dollar home right now because that market isn't proven out there right now. But if you look just to the south, there's a community. The number one selling neighborhood or community in Charlotte right now is Berwick, just to the south. And mm-hmm. So while you do drive around the River District and feel like you are at the end of the earth or maybe up near Asheville, you go 2 minutes to the south and there's a new Harris Teeter being built.
500,000 square feet of retail space. Put that into perspective. How big is that? I mean, is that like South Park? Is it like –
it's much smaller than South Park. To give you an idea, I think the goal for that 500,000 square feet would be a lot of little boxes. And let's also recognize – it may never get built. Only 200,000 may get built, 250. This is a process for entitling, and then the market will determine what is built. But to give you an idea, a typical IKEA, right, one single IKEA on average in the United States is about 350,000 square feet.
Oh, okay. So you're not talking about great big shopping mall. You're talking shops that will service the needs of people who locate there and people who work there, like
correct.
Dry cleaners and small markets and maybe a grocery store.
Or
a
brewery.
Really? We keep coming back to that.
We're talking to breweries right now who are very interested about being part of this.
Okay. And then you have 8 million square feet of office space. Compare that to Uptown.
Well, it's definitely smaller than Uptown. I mean, Uptown is the largest submarket in Charlotte. And again, this is something that would take place over time. And one of the things from a transit perspective, if we have nothing but residential out there, everyone then has to leave their home or apartment and get to where they work. So if we can locate jobs near where people live, mm-hmm. right, then you're eliminating or reducing the amount of infrastructure you need, right? The cheapest infrastructure is the stuff you don't have to build. So Eli probably helped me out. The Uptown submarket is north of 25 million square feet, 20?
I think it's closer in the 40s.
Yeah, right. So I was saying, I'm always thinking just Class A, mm-hmm. right? So 40 million square feet is Uptown across all classes, and we're talking about 8 million over 30-plus years out there.
Okay, so it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen over a long period of time.
Right.
When you build something like this from scratch, Mary Newsom, it's on vacant, never-before-developed land. It seems obviously easier to do this, to master plan it, so to speak, and look out your window and say, that's going here, this is going there, et cetera. But it also provides some challenges. What are they? Is it simply infrastructure challenges, getting the sewer and the water out there and the roads?
I think those are some of the challenges, and Brian is nodding yes. I think there's another challenge, and that's Brian referred to it kind of obliquely in the million-dollar house range. You don't know what the market is out there. I did an article that was published at plancharlotte.org just yesterday about the last rural areas in the county. Went out and talked to Sue Friday, who's lived out there for almost 40 years. She verifies that you don't get airplane noise there. Her opinion is that the lack of sewer was less important than the perception of West Charlotte. West Charlotte, West Mecklenburg are not perceived as the classy places to live the way South Charlotte has been.
But could this not be the next the catalyst that changes all
of
that?
Well, it possibly could be, and I think Crescent and Harris are hoping that that's the case. But when you go to get your financing, they're going to say, prove to me that you can do what you want to here, that people aren't just going to say, no, heck no, I'm not living over there.
Talk about that. That's a challenge. Talk about that.
It is a challenge. And one of the things we've gotten to know well over this last few years is West Charlotte. You know, whether the good work going on at Renaissance Walk that Laura Clark was doing there before she left, and getting to know LaWanna Mayfield, the city council representative. There's a great story with a lot of really good people working hard to change those perceptions about West Charlotte, to make it kind of a great quadrant. And we believe the stuff that's already happening just to the south at Berwick, which is the best-selling community in all of Charlotte, tells us that people want a place where they can walk, they have amenities, they can be close to the airport, they can get into town. So it is a bit of a gamble. That is development. Infrastructure is tough out here. It's not currently served by a good deal of it. But we're willing to kind of make that bet that over time we'll be able to deliver that in partnership with the city. And the city has done a pretty good job of kind of governing our ability to develop unless the infrastructure is in place.
What are you hearing from people in West Charlotte, longtime residents, anything, or businesses for that matter, anything at all about the prospect of this happening in their neighborhood?
Well, in the River District area specifically, I've talked with a few folks who are, you know, longtime residents like Sue Friday, who are a little sad about the changes coming, but some of them are also almost surprised that it's taken this long. I think there's fewer residents there and less reaction. Where I've really seen more of a strong feeling is in the Berwick and Steel Creek areas. I did a story a few months ago about the growing pains that those areas are experiencing, and folks there are really just seeing a massive influx of new residential development along with retail shops, new Harris Teeter, for example. And folks there in the Steel Creek area especially, who I talked to, are really concerned about their ability to handle the traffic and some of those smaller roads there that were two-lane country roads until just a couple years ago in some cases, are feeling a lot of the pressure. So that area of Southwest Charlotte is growing extremely rapidly but is running into some bottlenecks, especially along getting from here to there, the transit and road question.
And unlike South Carolina, that seems to plan ahead for these things, we play catch-up in North Carolina. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but let's come back and talk about these infrastructure challenges, particularly with road and transit and sewer, and the impact this may have on the actual Catawba River, because there have been problems because of development along the Catawba for years. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte, partnering through all phases of a project. The name has changed, but dedication to client service remains Bradley.com. And the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. newslandscape.com. We've had more access to information during this election than ever before, but the news landscape has been littered with misinformation. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, how fake stories have shaped the presidential race. And then tomorrow on this program at 9, with the election, we think, being over, the voters having spoken, what did they say, and how will it impact you going forward? We'll talk about that tomorrow at 9 on this program.
Aside from the latest news, thoughtful coverage, and balanced perspectives, we also bring you
a 5-week chess championship tournament in a prison.
This tale starts with a fish called the Totuaba.
News of the heist went viral, and the school was inundated with donated pumpkins.
That bloop came from two black holes colliding.
It's called All Things Considered for a reason. Listen every afternoon.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Voting is underway, but we're talking about development because you got to go vote. And the development we're talking about is the River District, which will be out between the airport and the Catawba River. It's being developed by Crescent Communities and Lincoln Harris. Brian Leary is here. He's president of commercial and mixed use with the, Crescent Communities. Mary Newsom is also with us, associate director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and their Urban and Regional Affairs Division, and Eli Portillo, reporter with the Charlotte Observer, is also here. Infrastructure. You're planning direct access to I-85 in the airport. Will that access require major new road development? Will it require a new interstate interchange?
So for the next 30 years, the development of the River District will require a good deal of upgraded infrastructure, particularly transportation infrastructure. And the city and the transportation department there have been very clear that they are not going to let the development of the River District get past a certain point before these things have to be done. And
who pays for all that?
Well, it's first and foremost, the River District, as proposed, if it gets built out, will generate about a little over $1 billion of new tax base. So if you just look at the dollars that are going to be thrown off in annual tax receipts when it's built, it would actually more than pay for itself. Now,
but there's a lag.
Pardon me?
There's a lag time.
There is a lag time, absolutely. Yeah. And so what that's called in business is an investment, right? You make an investment to generate a return in the future.
Right.
And that is literally the calculus that this area represents. And but at the same time, we are enthusiastic about obviously carrying in our own weight and putting our own infrastructure in, the connecting roads within the neighborhoods and stuff that we'll build, and entering into a public-private partnership. In many ways, through this rezoning process, we are at risk that if we don't figure out the infrastructure, we don't go past go. While there is some development as part of phase one that could be handled with the existing infrastructure, unless we can add some improvements to the West Boulevard interchange, some interconnecting streets, the extension of West Boulevard, which, by the way, is also on the ballot today. There's a City of Charlotte bond initiative that's on the ballot today that has usually been supported by citizens. So this is an area, to Mary's earlier point, West Charlotte had long been considered the you know, 4 out of 4 quadrants you might want to be in. And it's also been underinvested in a great deal. And so I think the people of West Charlotte are glad to see the investment coming.
When we talk about 4,000 housing units, Mary, and 500,000 square feet of retail space, and I think it was 8 million square feet of office space, and when this is all fully built out and occupied, I guess some of those people will live, work, and play there. But there will be traffic, and I'm told that you have – yeah, I know you've pointed out that there are concerns about increased traffic on West Boulevard and on Wilkinson Boulevard and even I-85.
Yeah, I think that there's two things going on here, and one is the in terms of infrastructure. One is what's the developer going to do to help ameliorate the problems in that vicinity? And to be clear, the developer will build the streets, and we're hoping that it will be a dense connected network. So that people don't have to drive around as much. The developer will put in the sewer lines that run down the streets. The ratepayers of CMUD, or excuse me, Charlotte Water, are going to absorb the cost of the major pieces that are going to have to be built. But then there's the bigger picture, which is how do you support the effects that the infrastructure needs that this development is going to throw off on the rest of the city? And this, Charlotte doesn't really have a strategy for that other than,
clearly,
well, we'll pay.
Yeah, because you ask a question in an article you wrote, did we learn anything from Ballantyne and its traffic? And My question back to you is, did we? Because clearly not.
I think we learned that there's going to be a lot of traffic. And I don't think that we learned how to better demand a different form going forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the state does not allow Charlotte-Mecklenburg to do a lot of things that they can do in South Carolina, for example. We can't ask developers to pay for impact fees, you know, pay up in addition to the roads, pay some money to help, you know, to help build parks, to help
Why
build
not?
Whatever. The legislature doesn't allow that. They allowed some counties to do it in the 80s, but then they stopped saying yes. So we don't have that. So now we have what's called exactions, which is basically the developer negotiates with the city. Yeah, or extractions is the other term. So the developers negotiate with the city or the county, but it's typically the city. How much will you give us in exchange for okaying it? And sometimes it's, I think at Ballantyne they built a whole interchange.
Right.
Because they had owned the land. Let me point out, Crissen has owned this land possibly for as long as a century. They are not paying a lot of mortgage fees on this land. The South Park and Ballantyne were land owned by the Harris family.
Right.
So they could put more money into this infrastructure. A lot of developers can't do that.
And Brian, you said I just looked at you when we were talking about traffic, and you say you have learned from Ballantyne. What have you learned?
Well, I think if you looked at Ballantyne, again, I'm not being negative about Ballantyne by any stretch, because a lot of great people live out there. But if you could take all the cars off the road of the folks who live in Ballantyne or work in Ballantyne, going to either where they live or work in Ballantyne,
right,
or a great number of them, I think you'd see there'd be a lot less traffic in Ballantyne. And so when Ballantyne was conceived, right, it was kind of the heyday of American suburbia. Things were separated, not connected, and they weren't that dense.
But getting to Ballantyne is like a nightmare come true. 485 is like a nightmare come true.
Unless you live there, right? Right. Well, and until Ballantyne –
But if Ballantyne weren't there, would 485 be the nightmare that it is? I would say no, because there'd be no reason to go down that leg of 485.
There'd be no reason to have 485 if there was no Ballantyne. So there you go.
Chicken and the egg. Right. Eli, chime in on this.
Well, I think that does get to one of the bigger concerns, which is maybe not so much how people get around inside mm-hmm. a development like the River District. I think the developers have spent a lot of time thinking about how to build a dense network of streets and greenway trails and footpaths within the development. I think when I talk to people in the community, especially in adjacent areas like Steel Creek, they are concerned about people getting to the River District and other communities like that. They're concerned about what happens in the bottlenecks of the roads around it. And there's not really any plan to run transit out there right now as things stand.
This seems like a great way to coax another train into existence, Mary. I mean, I think the argument could be made that we could have a connector, a light rail connector to the airport, and then it could keep going into this River District area. Is that something that could act as a Kickstarter for that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah, because you'll have a lot more people at the end of the line, so that might actually help your, you know, hey, we'll have riders, feds, give us some money. Because there aren't enough people to go and just go into the airport to make the feds want to give us money.
They keep building parking lots.
Yeah. The
Somebody's going there.
The other question is there's no money to pay for it. I mean, the half-cent sales tax does not bring in enough money to build any more transit lines, whether it's out west or down Independence Boulevard.
Are we adequately addressing this? Because this area has grown by leaps and bounds. It continues to grow by leaps and bounds. The idea is that the county is pretty much built out. It can't annex anything anymore. So it's going to have to, if it's going to survive, it's going to have to continue to densify. And if you densify, you can't build enough roads for the cars. So are we not going to have to address mass transit? And are we addressing it?
I think Brian and I were both shaking our heads. No, I don't think we're addressing it now. Are you guys going to dedicate transit line space?
We'd love to dedicate transit line space.
On your streets,
we would have that conversation right now. And throughout my career, I've been building transit-oriented development, day one, literally. Day one.
And you came from Atlanta, didn't you?
Came from Atlanta, yes. So don't hold that against me.
Look at that place.
Right? Close to 25 years. And there's two components to effective transit, right? It's the infrastructure itself, and that's many times a technology debate. And then it's transit-supportive land use. So first and foremost, we're addressing what we have under control, which is transit-supportive land use. So we are making sure that the master plan and the rezoning petition is the most transit-supportive we can make it in terms of the land use. Now, to Mary's point, it's not just transit. It's a transportation funding issue that we have as a nation, as a state, that we've relied on the gas tax to pay for everything. In many places, it prohibits dollars to be spent on transit, so we have to come up with little half of a penny here or there to kind of cobble things together. We are woefully underinvesting in infrastructure as a country. We had an interstate highway bridge fall into the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, but at the same time, we're the United States. So it doesn't make any sense. So from a transit perspective, I think – and I don't want to speak for John Lewis, who's a great leader at CATS. I think they've identified having a transit connection, a higher technology rail transit connection to the airport, is kind of a no-brainer. And in many ways, it's kind of already missing if we consider ourselves a 21st century international city. But I would argue that there are various forms of transit that could be running much faster, that might be much more affordable. And I don't want to get into the weeds on bus rapid transit, but you could deliver something like that at, say, 5 to 10 million a mile, where you might be at 50 million a mile for something different.
Now, you're also planning to keep 40% of the acreage as either natural area. That's a lot for greenways and parks and trails. That's all drawn into the master plan.
Correct.
Is the master plan for these square grid-like streets that connect so you can walk from your house to the grocery store, to your office if you work there? Is that all possible in that neighborhood?
Absolutely. And I think what's the reason why we're doing that, not only do you believe it's the right thing to do, and honestly, in the negotiations with the city, they were going to make us do it. We think that is literally what makes this place more valuable. We believe people will come here because of that.
Mm-hmm.
That is the differentiator.
And you're leaving additional land for two schools. You're setting aside land for two schools. You're also setting aside, as I said, land for parks. As I understand it, the land for the schools and the parks is going to be set aside for 7 years, and then the county in that 7 years has to ante up the money to buy that land from you. What if they can't? What if they can't find that money?
Well, a couple of things. If the second call we made after we called the city about this was the school system, because we cannot build a bunch of houses out there and expect people to move there with their families if we don't have good schools and enough schools. And so to the extent that something happens at the end of 7 years and the school system says, well, we need an eighth or we need 10, we are motivated as much as anyone, more so, to make sure that those schools are going in.
And you're meeting with the city on November 21st. It's a zoning meeting, but you're not meeting with the county, and the county pays for schools. The county pays for parks. Have you met with the county?
We have met with the county a number of times.
Okay.
And they are a fantastic partner and recognize that the investment that the private sector will be making in the River District will be generating quite a good return for the public side.
Crescent started as an offshoot, and I guess it still is in a way, of Duke Energy. Duke Energy, we all know, runs the chain of the waterway chain from Lake Mountain Island Lake and Lake Norman down through the Catawba into Lake Wylie. And argument can be made that they have been a very good steward of that. But as development has increased along those waterways, there has been some silt damage and things like that, drainage damage along the Catawba. What are you doing to protect the Catawba from this development?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, first, we're pulling development off the river. We're not going to be building much of anything on the river. Second, there's some really good lessons learned from even the development of the outlet center just to the south, where they were able to actually improve water quality and repair some of the things that had been maybe missed some years before. And so while I said the second call we made was the school system, I think the third call we made was to the riverkeeper. Because we really want to create a best practice and an exemplar place.
And what was the riverkeeper's reaction to this idea?
I'm sure at first it was a bit skeptical, right, because it's big. But at the same time, I think this is one thing that, you know, you don't ever say, trust me, kind of like the cover of Mad Magazine, right? But Lincoln Harris and Crescent have been in this community for a very long time. This is our home. I think most people would recognize that what we build separately together is high quality, it's respectful to the neighborhoods in which it builds, and is environmentally focused.
Are there flood management concerns? It's along the river. Are there flood management concerns about that area?
There are water concerns all over the land. So as I mentioned, literally the first lines we drew were the streams and then the floodways and then the watersheds. And we said we're going to stay out of all of those, even if you could build in them.
Stephen on Twitter writes, I hope Ballantyne isn't the model. Maybe a 21st century Reston, that's in Virginia in the suburbs of Washington, but with more diversity and affordable housing and jobs beyond just offices, 21st century startups perhaps.
I love it that he mentioned Reston. It's actually one that I was actually there for the opening of the Reston Town Center in 1990. And it is an analog for the River District. It very much is. So is the Woodlands in Texas. So is Serenby outside of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. We are looking at those places that have figured it out, whether it's the Stapleton redevelopment or the developments outside Seattle that have figured out a way to stay connected to the environment. So yes, Ballantyne is not the model. It's something we've learned from.
You look at this all over town. You look at development all over town, what we've done, where we're going, what we're planning to do, Mary, at the Urban Institute. What's your point of view on – do you have a point of view on this development? Not you personally, but the Urban Institute.
Well, the Urban Institute, we don't take positions okay. on things like that. We're nonpartisan, nonprofit. People hire us to do research, and if you stake yourself out as favoring one thing or another, mm-hmm. then half the people won't hire you. But my personal opinion is that this development, number one, it sounds like it's going to be better than what might be done by another developer. I have a degree of regret that Mecklenburg County 30 years ago didn't say, hey, we do want to have some green belts. We want to deliberately save some of our farms. So let's adopt some strategies to do that. Mecklenburg didn't do that. Other counties have done that. I think we have a huge missed opportunity along our public our waterfront. We don't have much public waterfront at all. But that's, so to speak, water over the dam or, water under the bridge.
Too late.
Too late. It is. I think we could be smarter about how we choose to pay for infrastructure, including transit. It doesn't have to be a sales tax, folks. You know, Houston built their light rail system with property taxes.
Now, don't go there. That's a whole other show. Mary Newsom with UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, Brian Leary, president of commercial and mixed use at Crescent Communities, and Eli Portillo, economic development reporter from the Charlotte Observer.